Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. This afternoon, I'm talking about one of Billy's writings called The Goblet of Truth. And in The Goblet of Truth, he mentions something called the Dark Order that is coming out of our governing class. And a lot of the alternative media talks about this Dark Order using a different name. They call it the New World Order. Let me read a passage from the Goblet of Truth. However, all the items named here only represent the start, because in secret there is a mighty organization of the governing class and mightful ones, as well as many of their obedient lackeys, emerging from amidst your humanity, who are creating a secret order of darkness with their own evil laws and ordinances, who are bent on hatred for the poor and weak and against the economically imprisoned and all normal citizens. Now, this organization that is coming out of the governing class is referred to by the name the Secret Order of Darkness in the Meyer writings. A class is a system of ordering of a society in which people are divided into sets based on perceived or economic status. Status in sociology is a social or professional position, condition, or standing to which varying degrees of responsibility, privilege, and esteem are attached. This dark order that the Goblet of Truth talks about wants more money. It wants an entire mastery over the whole earth. And Billy was told about this time that we live in, the third millennium, when he was a very young boy. Growing up in Bulak, Switzerland, he would have these contacts from this extraterrestrial human man named Svoth, who told him way back in 1945 that shortly the United States would drop the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and then we would go into this time called the third millennium. In the Meyer material, it's referred to as the time of confusion. It's also described this way. During the third millennium, we are told that our leaders will become megalomaniacal. They will overemphasize their own importance. Now, what happens to the people start to become obtuse. By obtuse, I mean very slow to understand, also insensitive. Annoyingly insensitive. People will also become indolent, too lazy to even put forth the effort to educate themselves or learn things. And this will cause an indifference in society. And that's why you look around you in the world and you see people so indifferent. They're almost in a state of hypnosis, focused on their iPods and their television shows and their YouTube videos and their sports. In the meanwhile, our beautiful earth is being destroyed by overpopulation, by technologies that are not healthy to the environment. And this dark order is working to gain more and more money and entire mastery over the whole earth. Money here refers to as assets, property, resources owned by someone or something, wealth. And we have this dark order, which some people call the New World Order, but really we have multiple dark orders today. We have secret societies and then partially secret societies. A secret society is any club where the activities and events are concealed from non-members. The secret society, there's also another society called Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard's group. We have the Skull and Bone Society from Yale. We have another secret society called the Quill and Dagger Society, which comes from another university. Paul Wolfowitz was a part of the Quill and Dagger Society. Paul Wolfowitz introduced what we call preemptive war, the preemptive war doctrine. I have a clip here that talks a little bit about these secret societies.
Expertise in thermite-related technologies played a large part in the NIST World Trade Center investigation. A few other names and companies inside the Twin Towers also worthy of further investigation include Craig Stapleton, who is married to Bush's cousin Dorothy Walker Bush. Stapleton was the president of Marsh Real Estate Advisors from 1982 to 2001. He was a member of the board of directors for Cendant that was charged with massive accounting fraud in 1998 and went on to join Winston Partners, a privately owned investment firm founded in 1993 and led by George W. Bush's brother, Marvin. Other very powerful and well-connected people worked in senior management at Marsh. These included Stephen Friedman, a senior principal at Marsh Capital and former partner at Goldman Sachs, who later became George W. Bush's top economic advisor. Friedman was also a member of the Brookings Institution, the Bilderberg Group, the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, and the board at InQtel, the investment firm founded by the CIA in 1998. InQtel invests in state-of-the-art technologies related to defense and intelligence work, including nano and chemical technologies, according to its website. In another interesting coincidence, Friedman belonged through Cornell University to a secret society called Quill and Dagger, the membership of which includes Paul Wolfowitz, Sandy Berger, and Stephen Hadley. Wolfowitz, the neocon Deputy Secretary of Defense in the Bush administration, was the author in 1992 of the Wolfowitz Doctrine of Preemptive Warfare. He also made comments about a surprise like Pearl Harbor months before 9/11 and met with Pakistani ISI General Mahmoud Ahmed in the week before 9/11. Berger, the National Security Advisor to President Clinton, was later caught stealing documents from the 9/11 Commission investigation. Berger was also the boss of White House counterterrorism czar Richard Clark, and together with Hadley, who was Condoleezza Rice's deputy, was responsible for delaying or obstructing Clark's plans to stop al-Qaeda in January of 2001. Jeffrey Greenberg resigned from Marsh & McLennan after being accused of serious financial crimes. The first plane of 9/11 flew directly into his company's secure computer room in the North Tower. Jeffrey Greenberg is a member of the Brookings Institution and the Trilateral Commission. Jeffrey Greenberg rose quickly through management at Marsh, having come there directly from AIG in 1995, and then becoming CEO just 4 years later. At Brookings, Greenberg hobnobbed with Lee Hamilton, co-chair of the 9/11 Commission. There's also Jim Pierce, another Bush cousin, who was managing director of Aon Corporation, who, according to the NIST report, modified unknown sections of Floor 83 in the South Tower in 1997. Jim Pierce had arranged a meeting on the 105th floor of the South Tower for that morning. Pierce survived that day, despite the fact that 12 people came to the meeting in the South Tower and 11 of them died. The location of the meeting had been changed the night before to the Millennium Hotel, where Pierce watched the South Tower as it was hit by the aircraft. Apparently, the meeting attendees were not all notified of the change in location. Another interesting character is Joseph Caspudis of Baseline Financial Service, which occupied the impact zone of the South Tower on floors 77 and 78, where United Airlines 175 impacted. Caspudis has a history of being well connected to the highest levels of government, as well as to the defense and intelligence industries. Caspudis worked from 1972 to 1977 for the U.S. Department of Commerce and Defense. He was also the deputy director of Nixon's White House task force that dealt with the Arab oil embargo of 1973, and was instrumental in the creation of the Department of Energy. Caspudis went on to run a large corporation called Primark that had offices in both towers on 9/11. One of the subsidiaries of Primark, the Analytical Sciences Corporation, TASC, worked with so-called black or top-secret programs. TASC also worked closely with the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Caspudis was also a member of the Logistics Management Institute, LMI, whose members included Paul Kaminsky of InQtel and General Dynamics, Charles DeBona of Halliburton, Skull and Bones member Joseph Samuel Nye, and Michael Daniels of Scientific Applications International Corporation. LMI's self-proclaimed role is advancing the science of government. Caspudi's connections to the DOE from 1977 through at least 1997 are interesting, considering that the DOE was developing thermite ignition devices as early as 1983. Joseph Caspudi's went on to become the CEO of Baseline Financial Services, which was directly in the impact zone on the 78th floor of the South Tower. According to NIST, Caspudi's Baseline Financial modified the southeast corner of floor 78 in 1999, exactly where the aircraft hit on 9/11. Floor 76.
Well, that's some of the functions of this dark order. I think they probably had something to do with 9/11. Exactly what, I'm not sure. But this dark order is spreading hatred everywhere. The Meyer material talks about the first creational natural law, which is love, in that this universe that we live in, this creation, that it radiates love, and that the incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of the love of creation, and that creation's highest principle is love. Now, this love that I'm talking about is not an emotional love. It's not an affective love. It's not a romantic love, but it's a very consistent and stable love. I always relate it back to that feeling of sunshine, the warmth of sunshine. But nature radiates this love. So this dark order that's spreading around, this deep and emotional extreme dislike, this hatred is operating in opposition to what is normal, what is natural for all of nature, for all of creation. There's this interesting passage, I think it's also in the Goblet of Truth, that says that the life-giving energy of creation is trying to come into harmonious concord with all people, with the entire earth, and with the whole universe. So we have in stark contrast to creation, which one of Billy's contacts, Semyasi, said that love and wisdom go together, and that creation and its laws are love and wisdom at the same time. This dark order is spreading hatred, mostly hatred for the people that are not at their same class level. That's why I brought up the whole point of classes. And looking at society in classes is very unhealthy. Now, hatred is often associated with feelings of anger, disgust, and a disposition towards hostility. And the Meyer information uses the word poison here to describe this hatred that is being spread around. In the context of biology, poisons are substances that cause disturbances in organisms, usually by a chemical reaction or another activity on a molecular scale, when a sufficient quantity of a poison has been ingested. It can even cause, in some cases, death. Now, what's happening in our society is an idleness is forming in humanity. And let me read what it says here in the Goblet of Truth. Therefore, you human beings of earth are no longer active to any great extent, but you go along in idleness with an empty expression in your eyes, not knowing what you should do and where you should go, because you have nothing else that brings you joy or good reward. Now, when you're describing idleness, you can look at idleness in a person or a machine. It means the act of nothing or no work. A computer processor or a communication circuit is described as idle when it is not being used by any program or message. So what is happening is people are demoralized and hopeless. And the reason they're demoralized and hopeless is because they're running in opposition to the normal way of nature. You see, our society is an aberration. An aberration is something that hasn't evolved along normal lines. And Billy describes Earth humans now as being those who cannot set down roots because people are demoralized. They're hopeless. Now, demoralization means to lose confidence, to become disheartened. Heartened. To be hopeless means a feeling of despair. Billy talks about people that are bereft. And now bereft means deprived or lacking of something. In this case, people are bereft of work and bereft of a home. Billy talks about people who are lacking permanent housing. Homelessness in the United States is an area of concern for everyone. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development in January 2012 said that there were 633,000 people all across America who were homeless. And there were an estimated almost 58,000 homeless veterans. Now, let me read again from a passage in the Goblet of Truth. And you human beings of earth, both young and old, are the ones who no longer set down roots in your life. You wander. You are demoralized and hopeless. You are bereft of work and home, with the result that you fight yourself in all things, and you hate your present existence. What does it mean to fight yourself in something? Well, one of the sources of fighting ourselves can be cognitive dissonance. When you have cognitive dissonance, you have two ideas that are in opposition to each other, and your subconscious is trying to resolve this. You have two distinct ideas, two belief patterns that disagree, and people are struggling with this fighting themselves. And I would say if you have thoughts like this, it's analogous to a weed that exists in a garden, a weed that is choking out all life in that garden. And that's what's happening to people's consciousnesses. Your consciousness is like a garden. You have to constantly monitor it and look for these thoughts that are too negative or too positive. You want to be neutral, positive in your thinking. If you're not, you can drive yourself crazy and eventually commit suicide. Listen to what it says here. With the result that you fight yourself in all things and you hate your present existence to the extent of finally bringing it to an end yourself, as already has been the case to an increasing extent in the 20th century, and will become ever more widespread in the future. Let me read some statistics on United States military veterans committing suicide. About 6,500 military personnel killed themselves in 2012. In a study from 1999 to 2010, it showed that 22 veterans were committing suicide every day. That's close to one suicide by a veteran every hour. Now, this idea of cognitive dissonance in psychology is the mental stress or discomfort experienced by an individual who holds two or more contradictory beliefs, ideas, or values at the same time. And I think many people are experiencing cognitive dissonance today, which may lead to suicide. Suicide is not a good thing. We definitely, the Meyer information always talks against suicide, because the purpose of your life on this earth is evolution of your consciousness. When you're a child, something called the spirit form comes into the body at 21 days. Now, that spirit form has lived before. And the purpose of a material lifetime is to evolve your consciousness, because every single new lifetime, we get a new material consciousness. And that new material consciousness has to learn again. But deep within your subconscious is experiences and wisdom from your predecessor personalities. These will inspire you in this lifetime. And you'll get impulses from the Universal Storage Banks. And Billy talks about these signals, these impulses. And Billy was so sensitive to these. He was getting these at 4 years of age. He would wake up in the middle of the night, go outside his bedroom in Bulak, Switzerland, go outside and look up at a beautiful starry sky and just literally absorb these impulses. Because the whole universal consciousness wants to come into harmonious concord with all life, with the entire planet, with the entire universe. Take the time to go into nature. Take the time to clear your mind. Go into a neutral state. Only focus on images. Push out all verbal thinking in your mind. Clarify your thoughts. Do some deep breathing if you have to. Rid yourself of all negative energies. Come into control of your own thinking. Learning to control your own thinking is the key to happiness. Remember spiritual poise talked about in Contact Report 10? Freedom from disturbance. Happiness is never a location. Happiness starts with your thinking. Learning to control your thinking. Because the suicide epidemic is because thoughts are running outside control completely. These negative thoughts are running completely out of control, and some of these medications don't help. They actually make things worse. So we need to reconnect with nature. We need to look at our own thoughts, and we need to set ourselves back in equalization. We want to be equalized. We want to be balanced again. Now, because not only do we have the dark order that's causing problems intentionally, that's trying to seek control of the entire earth, we also have nature that has all kinds of problems. One of the big problems right now is the California drought, because there are such a high population, we're literally in some areas of the country using up all of the water, all the fresh water, and depleting our aquifers. Let's listen to this clip.
Ya no es California que era antes, supuestamente. Mis padres contaban mucho de que era precioso, era un fruterío enorme. Ahorita no, ya no. Ya el trabajo ha decaído demasiado.
Standing in the San Luis Reservoir, which is one of the larger reservoirs in the Central Valley. As you can see to my left, the high water mark from wet years is way higher than the level is right now. To the right, today, you can see how the entire reservoir has been depleted almost to the point of being dry. Having grown up in California, I've never seen reservoirs this low before, and it's pretty shocking.
The current drought in California is responsible for at least 410,000 acres of stagnant farmland. Last year alone saw more than $800 million of lost profits due to the state's lack of water. While the problem is statewide, one city which is seeing upwards of 40% unemployment due to this devastating drought is Mendota. Known as the Cantaloupe Center of the World, it's been more recently termed the Detroit of California and the Appalachia of the West. So to see firsthand the social cost our changing climate has taken on these farming communities, we headed to Mendota, located a couple hours south of San Jose in California's Central Valley.
So we're out here in the Central Valley, here visiting Joe Del Bosque and his farm, to see kind of how the drought is affecting things. And you actually had a big visitor, President Obama.
That's right. Back in February, we had the honor to have the president right here at this spot to come and listen and talk about the drought.
As anybody in this state could tell you, California is living through some of its driest years in a century. Right now, almost 99% of California is drier than normal. California is our biggest economy. California is our biggest agricultural producer. So what happens here matters to every working American, right down to the cost of food that you put on your table.
So what's changed since then?
Well, we don't have any water still. So not a lot has changed in that respect. You know, drought here for us can be a disaster, but you don't see things like you do with an earthquake where things are knocked down and broken. What you see here with a drought is just land doing nothing with no crops growing on it. Out of 2,000 acres, I have left fallow 600 acres due to the drought. My family originally came from Mexico into Imperial Valley when they brought water from the Colorado River there. Then in the 50s, my father was offered a permanent job here, and he became the ranch manager. In 1985, I started my own farm, actually right here across the road.
It sounds like the American dream right there. I mean, being able to set up shop.
It really was. You know, this land here, when it grows cantaloupes, we will have 150 people working in this field for at least 3 weeks. And those wages are going to be lost this year.
So you're talking about a smaller town like Mendota. I mean, when you add that up across everyone who's farming here, that's a significant loss of revenue just for the town, right?
Absolutely.
And so how much of your workforce did you have to cut off as well?
Probably close to 25%. The University of California has done a study on this drought this year, and they're estimating that 17,000 farm worker jobs are going to be lost.
Since records began to be kept in the late 19th century, this is the third driest single year that we've had. So if you combine with that the fact that it was also the hottest year on record, that means that it's been a pretty bad drought. A lot of our water falls as rain or as snow up in the north and in the eastern mountains. That water then gets stored either in the snowpack for a while it stays cold, then it goes into surface reservoirs, and then it travels down through the Sacramento River system, through the Delta, and there are actually two big aqueducts that it goes into then. There's one that's called the Delta Mendota Canal, and that's mainly delivering water to farmland in the San Joaquin Valley. Then there's another aqueduct called the California Aqueduct. At some places, they're almost right next to each other. That one
The waters fall into Northern California, and they go into the Sacramento River system and then into these whole system of aqueducts. And as all of these large cities like San Francisco and Los Angeles and San Diego take water out of this water system, it becomes more and more depleted. And as the population gets larger and larger in Southern California, more and more water is depleted. Now, some of the statistics I want to throw out real quick on population. Roughly 4 million people are born on the street and die on the street in India every year. 18 million people starve to death around the world. Bangladesh, a country the size of Iowa, has a population of 167 million. That's more people than live in Russia. Currently, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and California don't possess enough water for the residents. Now, the largest user of water is agriculture, and we need agriculture to use water because we're trying to grow food for all of these people. There is a coming global water crisis. In the United States, one of the central aquifers that are being depleted, is the Ogallala Aquifer. It's a shallow water table. It's located beneath the Great Plains. It's one of our largest aquifers. The normal depth of the Ogallala would be 240 feet. However, today its average depth is down to 80 feet. And scientists estimate it would take roughly 6,000 years to replenish this aquifer through rainfall. Now, America will add another 100 million people by 2035 because of immigration. So the problems of drought and the problems that we're going to see because of overpopulation are a little more than we can even understand at this point. Now, I like to play something from a guy named Peter Joseph that has, you know, in some ways agrees with the Meyer information, in some ways he doesn't, but enough that I think it's worth listening to. Our politicians have no legal reason to uphold any of their promises during their campaigns. We're spending incredible amounts of money to bail out these failing banks, and these banks, I think, are related to the dark order that we started talking about. So let me see if I can find this other clip by Peter Joseph. He has a whole series of clips on YouTube called Culture in Decline. Let's take a listen here for about 4 minutes.
Actually has zero say when it comes to the actual decisions made by those elected. It's bad enough that those voted in have literally no legal responsibility to do anything they might have claimed on the campaign trail. But if you examine history, you will find the historical fact that the public good has always been secondary to other interests, mainly financial and business interests. Of course, this is common knowledge now, right? I mean, why did the U.S. government, completely against all known public interest, allow the private banking system, a system which actually creates nothing, to be bailed out to the tune of $13 trillion?
You have a $14 million oceanfront home in Florida. You have a summer vacation home in Sun Valley, Idaho. You and your wife have an art collection filled with million-dollar paintings.
While the public was left out to dry with overflowing private debt, job losses, and a stagnating economy. You know, if we're going to persist with this silly little game we've concocted called the growth economy, where the movement of money defines everything, it might be a good idea to do the math regarding what might actually help this economic system operate at some passable level.
Therefore, if you raise taxes on the so-called rich, you're really raising taxes on the job creators. And if the goal is private sector growth, you got to recognize that the best way to create that growth is to leave capital in the treasuries of the job creators.
If that money spent on the bank bailout was spent on, say, relieving private household debt instead, while letting Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, and all of the other technically meaningless, non-producing financial institutions experience the failure and bankruptcy they deserved, simultaneously nationalizing the entire U.S. banking system as a whole, the U.S. economy might have had a chance. Why? Because banks don't actually contribute anything. People with jobs do. You want growth in this type of system, you need jobs. You want jobs, you need demand, and demand requires people having free money to spend. So by helping the public debt burden, you would plant the true seeds of economic growth. Well, of course, as obvious as that may seem, many forget one thing. The bailout had nothing to do with helping the U.S. economy, nor does it or will it work to help any hurting sovereign economy in the world. Why? Because we live in a plutocracy, not a democracy, and the only true power is actually behind the curtain, not in front. The financial and business powers not only own and control this country, they own and control the whole planet. And no, it's not a conspiracy. It's a value system disorder. As long as a dollar sign is associated with every blade of grass, every plot of land, every fleeting thought or invention, not to mention judging the merit of individuals for their right to life through labor, we should expect nothing less. Since the inception of the state itself, coupled with the underlying power of money as the ultimate driver of human decisions and hence persuasion, the true power has always been financial, and those little people you elect into office every couple of years, they have owners too, and don't you forget it.
Democracy, is that something you believe in as it exists today in America?
Well, when you say as in believe in, does it exist like forest fires or God or the devil?
What is your opinion of the American democratic system as it exists?
It's broken. It's deeply, deeply broken.
Democracy goes, of course, to Greece, and it's the theory that the people own the government. And is it in practice happening in 2012 in this country? Not close. It's a corporatocracy.
So all of this considered, let's now think a little more accurately about this whole democracy deal.
There we go. The whole idea of the government that we have, is it working? Is it serving our personal interests? Is it serving the people who elected it? Or is it serving this dark order, the people in our governing class? Is it serving to help make the rich get even richer? And the problem is most all of these policies that are coming out of our government that these large corporations support also have a very, very negative impact on our environment. And the origin of many of our problems, many of our environmental problems, is overpopulation. Now, many authorities and governments do not want to accept this as true. Let me read what it says in Figu Special Bulletin 32. Therefore, with the third millennium, the time has already dawned in which these things have quickly found their beginning and will develop ever more rapidly the longer they persist. As a result, the number of diseases and plagues is increasing. The number of illnesses that severely impair drinking water and bodies of water because of poisons of various kinds, as well as the air, the soil, the foodstuffs which grow on trees and bushes, as well as in the fields, woods, garden, and greenhouse. And still your efforts to counteract all the disasters are in vain, as are your attempts to put a brake on this development, because it is becoming greater and greater, more catastrophic with every day, indeed, with every hour and minute standing in relation to the rapid increase in overpopulation. Now, we've had, even in specific areas of the earth in history, we've had overpopulation in specific regions, but nothing like we have now, at least nothing in our recorded history, where we have, 8 to 9 billion people now. However, if you go back 2,700 years ago, drought and overpopulation helped destroy the Assyrian Empire. At least one study says, researchers see parallels with modern Syria and Iraq and caution other regions also facing weather stresses. There's a researcher, his name is Adam Schneider of the University of California, San Diego, who is working with another person in a university in Turkey. They have just published evidence. And it goes like this. As far as we know, ours is the first study to put forward the hypothesis that climate change, specifically drought, helped destroy the Assyrian Empire, says Adam Schneider, a doctoral candidate in anthropology at the University of California, San Diego. And the first author on the paper in this journal, Climatic Change. I want to go back to this whole idea of the drought in California. California drought. Here we go.
Who are beyond the end of that first canal. And then it also delivers water to the Bay Area, Santa Barbara, in Los Angeles, and all the way down to San Diego. California, like most Western states, has a system called appropriative water rights, and that's a fancy legal term for saying if you got there first, you're first in line. And it goes back to, in California, to mining days, right around statehood, the gold rush. They had to set up systems where they could move the water, they built canals. In order to do that, they adopted a set of rules on who owned it based very much on the way you would stake a mining claim. And so we have older water rights, more senior water rights, that in a time of drought, they're going to get their water before the folks that came later. And the folks who do farming in the west side of the San Joaquin Valley area, where Mendota is, are relatively junior. So they didn't get much, if any, water this year from their normal surface allocations. And that hits a community like Mendota really hard, because that's basically a farm worker community.
So, Joe, you see people driving down the interstate behind us, and they don't necessarily know the water politics in California. They look at these canals and they say there's plenty of water, but that's not your water, is it?
No. It's mostly going south to Southern California.
So you could be sitting here on your farm, or all of these farms could be collapsing under drought. There's plenty of water here, but if it's not what you're allocated, it's not coming out of the canal to save you.
We cannot take any water out of here. That's correct. There are turnouts for us. They're metered and measured, and they know that when we're out of water, they'll put a lock on it.
So we're driving through Mendota right now, about to meet up with our guy Joe, who's a farm worker and truck driver and does a few other odd jobs to keep paying the rent.
You were born here?
I was born in Fresno.
Yeah.
80s baby.
Were you mostly doing like farm work in the past, or how did that go?
I've done a little bit of everything, from moving sprinkler lines to planting tomatoes, planting melons, planting pistachios, almond trees. You got guys that have been working for 30 years for the same ranch, getting paid minimum wage, dude. And they're satisfied with that, but just because of the fact that they got that steady job, you know?
Has there been more pressure on that in the past few years because there's fewer jobs, or what?
I mean, you got people that are driving an hour and a half, 2 hours away from here, dude, just to work.
Just for the day?
Yeah, for the day, the same pay, man. Like, you know, a few years back, 5-6 years, it was still decent work. You know, the seasons were longer. You know, there was more fields, you know, more fruit. The fact that there ain't no water, man, it really is affecting people, you know.
For farm worker communities like Mendota and others, there are long-term questions about the economic future of these places and how to find transitions for the folks that live in these communities, so that they're not living in continual economic hardship. And some of that may mean leaving the agricultural sector and leaving those towns.
I got another clip on the California drought I want to play here. This is just very interesting stuff.
This is just one of many bags that we've had for meth pipes. Probably within here alone, there's probably 300-400 meth pipes alone. As you can see, it's a little crisis that we have out here. We have an unwanted subject at this residence. Apparently they're banging on the door. It looks like he might have some kind of weapon in his hand. I guess you could sort of say it's like a housing place for some of the MS-13 guys. T, you have a description or anything? All right. Be careful with this house. This is that house with all those Mara guys. Ask him a little bit more questions to see if it's anything drug related. So I've been here roughly broke the 2-year marker this year.
And so you're starting to think about moving elsewhere, or I don't know what the usual time is that people want to stay?
Yeah. You know, that's exactly what I had in mind right now. Unfortunately, it's a low rate, starting off at $17 an hour, which, to be completely honest, is really anything for the stuff that we actually have to, you know, endure with this career and this profession.
What are kind of the challenges that are unique to a smaller community like this?
There's obviously a decrease, you know, in the jobs out here, especially for the field workers, So I would say that, you know, it does have something to do with the amount of calls that we get and crime going up. Just for the fact that people have more time, they're out and about, they really don't have much to do. So, you know, what do? They drink. And unfortunately, do methamphetamine.
Is he drinking a beer? I think he is. I think we're pulling over a couple of guys on horses right now.
¿Cómo estás?
Bien.
Mira, soy un problema, okay?
¿Mane?
Tenemos un problema, ¿ok? Si estás con tu caballo aquí, no puedes tomar, ¿ok? No puedes tomar afuera, ¿ok?
Si estás... You know, we've talked to a lot of people about the connection between the drought and basically the collapse of, you know, work and crime. With everything the officers have said, it sounds like there's a pretty definite relationship there.
this is where all our homeless people stay. They built these makeshift tents out of recyclable stuff that they found within the city, and they stay here.
And so these are all people that are coming in to look for work?
Yeah, but unfortunately, the work isn't really out here that much. They have to resort to this kind of living. That's actually their restroom.
There's a hole drilled under that pallet,
exactly.
Or dug under the pallet. Wow.
Exactly.
I mean, we are still in California, right?
Yeah.
You've been staying out here?
We came out here because we saw a rattlesnake out there, man.
En el campo ya no hay trabajo, ya se acabó.
Y de
pues
todo lo que pudo.
No le gustó estar aquí, o tuvo que, ¿qué íbamos a pensar que íbamos a estar aquí?
Estaba cortando el árbol y me fui para atrás, salió una rama y es crack, y no me la atendí. Y a mí no me han ayudado para nada, y desde ese tiempo pues ya dejé de trabajar. Yo lo que hago ahorita para sostenerme. Es como yo le he dicho a varios, yo no ando pidiendo limosna, ni ando robando, ni nada.
No,
yo hago mis muebles,
ve.
Yo de ahí como, yo de ahí me sostengo, ¿me entiendes? Simple y sencillamente no subaste lo suficiente para todos los agricultores, tener la suficiente producción para el trabajo del campo, para la alimentación de todos los... Y pues realmente no es culpa ni de ellos ni nadie, sino que simplemente es culpa de...
Anyway, the drought goes on in California. Doesn't get much attention in our news anymore, but the drought is more than just in Southern California. It's also because of the depletion of the Ogallala Aquifer, which is in the, again, the Great Plains. And there's places in Texas now that are experiencing drought. States like Colorado lost 1.65 million acres of farmland to development. We're seeing the pollution of our oceans and our rivers around the world. We're seeing starvation, particularly in Africa. 6 out of 8 children that are born to women in Africa die. Fertile regions can no longer be cultivated, and cities are being built on fertile regions which could grow food. People no longer, unfortunately, even lift a finger today to create their own food. People are having to live with all kinds of unreasonable thinking that are coming from our governments. Our governments are using power in an arbitrary and unrestrained way. We're no longer able even to recognize the problem of overpopulation because people have developed a kind of, they're used to 7 or 8 lanes of traffic. They're used to overcrowding. They're used to these things, but it's going to become worse, and it will become even worse. Pseudo-relief can eventually lead to a temporary help. If we give food to these places in third world countries of overpopulation, that will eventually lead to more overpopulation. The entire planet is being destroyed by the rapid increase in human population. The oxygen-rich rainforests are what regulates our climate. We're clearing our rainforests and burning our forests and destroying the wooded areas at a higher rate. Now, there are more and more people that are coming forward to talk about the problem of overpopulation, which is a good thing. There are more people talking about the dark order that I started the show today talking about. And so that's good. But we are in a very, very difficult situation. And it's really interesting if you look at this historically in terms of the Meyer information, because we've had now 7 prophets that have incarnated on the earth here. The first, at his time, he was called Henoch. We call him Enoch. And then we also had another prophet born called Eliah, who we call Elijah. And then the third prophet was Jeziah or Isaiah. And then we had Jeremiah, who we call Jeremiah. And then Emmanuel, whose name was eventually kind of changed over time to Jesus, then Muhammad, whose name always was Muhammad. And then finally the seventh prophet, Edward Albert Meyer. Very ancient spirit form that has incarnated on the earth once again with a whole series of very, very sobering prophets, a prophetic information that talks about events that could occur in our lifetime. We're seeing the overpopulation. We're seeing the droughts. We're seeing much of the information that's been talked about in the Meyer material. I got another short clip here on the California drought.
Unos a los otros, que hay que dejar el egoísmo a un lado. Bendito sea Dios que llueva todo lo que Él quiera. ¿Por qué? Porque el campo lo requiere y toda la humanidad lo requiere.
I want to make sure that every Californian knows your country is going to be there for you when you need it this year, but we're going to have to all work together in the years to come to make sure that we address the challenge and leave this incredible land and bounty to our children and our grandchildren in at least as good shape as we found it.
And the president said at the end of his speech that he was going to try to dedicate $1 billion to climate change. That's great, but climate change is very slow. We may never even see the results of that. It's certainly not going to help us in droughts in my lifetime. I'm not saying that the government's wrong in trying to do something about climate change, but in the meantime, we have to do something about now. There hasn't been anything for us. We don't want money. We want water. We have been very good at taking water in wet years and stretching it and carrying it through the dry years. But this is the longest dry spell that we've had and the worst dry spell that we've had for 20 or 25 years. And that is a very scary thought for us farmers. If it's a dry year, then it is total devastation for us.
With the drought continuing to plague California, and with archaic water systems unable to support the increasing demands and needs of the surrounding communities, the outlook for 2015 is bleaker than ever.
I've been farming almost 30 years, and this could be the end.
Regardless of a few recent rainstorms, communities like Mendota and the future of farming in the state have an unsettling and disheartening future.
So on the one hand, we have drought, we have overpopulation, and on the other hand, we have the corruption of our government institutions. I'm going to pick back up with Peter Joseph here, who has made a whole series of YouTube videos that talk about our culture, the culture in decline.
For us, a critical question becomes, where do these people come from? Why are they the ones on your TV and not others? Did you decide that these people are the best choices to compete for such critical leadership? Or have you noticed that the most pronounced candidates, especially the presidential, sort of come out of nowhere and through the media are given credence merely by repetition of exposure? The term democracy comes from the Greek demos, which means people, and krates, which means rule. And so the people of a given society express their opinions through votes, and policy is created by the majority's interest. It appears the process was formalized in ancient Greece and has been adapting ever since. However, it didn't take long for a bit of cynicism to emerge with respect to the process itself, given the fact that the entire basis of the idea assumes that the voting public actually is educated enough to know what they're doing. Franklin D. Roosevelt once acutely stated, "Democracy cannot succeed unless those who express their choice are prepared to choose wisely. The real safeguard of democracy, therefore, is education." Winston Churchill, on the other hand, was a little less forgiving, stating, "The best argument against democracy is a five-minute conversation with the average voter." And, of course, the infamous Mark Twain jumped to the inevitable punchline, stating, "If voting made any difference, they wouldn't let us do it." I would like you to ask yourself, if we were in the ruling class, the investment ownership class, to paraphrase Thorsten Veblen, and we wanted to preserve our interests against any interference, what would we do? Well, first we need to take the broadest possible view we can. We need to make sure the voting public is as uninformed as possible regarding relevant issues that might contradict our establishment's practices. Coupled with that, we also need to eliminate as much independent, logical, causal, scientific thought as possible. So, let's support an extremely underfunded, outdated, and deprived public educational system. A system focused on merely getting a person a job one day, not teach them how to critically and logically think.
At the heart of democracy really is the basic assumption that the public is well educated about critical thought, they know how to think about things and evaluate, and therefore they can make proper decisions, right? What is your opinion on American education and hence its effect on the democratic process?
I think that, you know, we have multiple problems in the education in America. One, I think we're dealing with the dumbing down of America.
And do you feel that this sort of poor educational system actually benefits the establishment?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Keep them stupid. Keep them easily entertained. If they're uninformed, they can't fight back.
However, to further reinforce this, we also need to push and reward belief systems that support passive obedience. Belief systems and values that are stubborn, irrational, and promote closed thinking. Religion becomes super helpful in this circumstance.
Is it possible that religion is being politicized and that candidates are using it as a tool?
I believe that God created the universe.
And we're enjoined by Scripture and the Lord Jesus to oppose it with all our might.
Let us not pray that God is on our side in a war or any other time, but let us pray that we are on God's side.
May God bless the Seventh-day Adventist Church.
I thank the God who loves us, the God who gave us life, who gave us our being.
And so to every sailor, soldier, airman, and marine who's involved in this mission, let me say, you're doing God's work.
If people are groomed to be obedient and follow blindly, they are ripe to extend that obedience to others who claim authority. Check. Next, it's critical we recognize a unique sociological characteristic of the human condition, something we will call herd psychology. This is the tendency for us humans, when faced with mass appeal, to often behave in extremely thoughtless and malleable ways. In the words of Charles McKay, famed author of Extraordinary Popular Delusions and The Madness of Crowds, "Men, it has been said, think in herds. It will be seen that they go mad in herds, while they only recover their senses slowly and one by one." However, this doesn't just apply to, say, a soccer riot. Such mob persuasion can be generated through simply shared cultural events. Remember September 11th? Talk about mass insanity. This event created an immediate crowd madness with fear and revenge.
Anyway, we're seeing the dumbing down of America. The Meyer material puts it this way: people are becoming indolent, obtuse, and indifferent. Peter Joseph there describes the herd mentality and the way our culture is in decline. So let's turn this around, folks. Let's pay attention to the creational natural laws. Let's try to learn as much as we can. Let's respect nature. And we'll catch you next time on Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. Have a good day.